We're going back to the office.
What about me?
Freddy asks plaintively. You're coming. And Freddy?
What?
Pot's good for pain, isn't it?
Opinions on that vary, as you might guess. The establishment in this fucked-up country being what it is, so all I can tell you is that for me, it makes that delicate time of the month a lot less delicate.
Bring it along, Hodges says. Also the rolling papers. 19. They go back to Finders Keepers in Jerome's Jeep. The back is full of Jerome's junk, meaning Freddy has to sit on someone's lap, and it's not going to be Hodges, not in his current condition. So he drives, and Jerome gets Freddy.
Hey, this is sort of like getting a date with John Shaft, Freddy says with a smirk. The big private dick who's a sex machine to all the chicks.
Don't get used to it, Jerome says. Holly's cell rings. It's a guy named Trevor Jepson from the police department's computer forensic squad. Holly is soon speaking in a jargon Hodges doesn't understand, something about bots and the darknet. Whatever she's getting back from the guy seems to please her, because when she breaks the connection, she's smiling.
He's never dosed a website before. He's like a kid on Christmas morning.
How long will it take?
With the password and the IP address already in hand, not long.
Hodges parks in one of the 30-minute spaces in front of the Turner building. They won't be here long, if he gets lucky, that is, and given his recent run of bad luck, he considers the universe owes him a good turn. He goes into his office, closes the door, then hunts through his ratty old address book for Becky Helmington's number. Holly has offered to program the address book into his phone, but Hodges has kept putting it off. He likes his old address book. Probably never get around to making the changeover now, he thinks. Trent's last case and all that. Becky reminds him she doesn't work in the bucket any longer.
Maybe you forgot that?
I didn't forget. You know about Babineau? Her voice drops.
God, yes. I heard that Al Brooks, Library Al, killed Babineau's wife and might have killed him. I can hardly believe it.
I could tell you lots of stuff you'd hardly believe, Hodges thinks. Don't count Babineau out yet, Becky. I think he might be on the run. He was giving Brady Hartsfield experimental drugs of some kind, and they may have played a part in Hartsfield's death.
Jesus, for real?
For real. But he can't be too far, not with this storm coming in. Can you think of any place he might have gone? Does Babineau own a summer cottage, anything like that? She doesn't even need to think about it.
Not a cottage. A hunting camp. It isn't just him, though. Four or maybe five docs co-own the place.
Her voice drops to that confidential pitch again.
I hear they do more than hunt out there, if you know what I mean.
Where is out there?
Lake Charles. The camp has some cutesy, horrible name. I can't remember it offhand, but I bet Violet Tran would know. She spent a weekend there once, said it was the drunkest 48 hours of her life, and she came back with chlamydia.
Will you call her?
Sure, but if he's on the run, he might be on a plane, you know. Maybe to California or even overseas. The flights were still taking off and landing this morning.
I don't think he would have dared to try the airport with the police looking for him. Thanks, Becky. Call me back. He goes to the safe and punches in the combination. The sock filled with ball bearings, his happy slapper, is back home, but both of his handguns are here. One is the Glock 40 he carried on the job. The other is a 38, the Victory model. It was his father's. He takes a canvas sack from the top shelf of the safe, puts the guns and four boxes of ammunition into it, then gives the drawstring a hard yank. No heart attack to stop me this time, Brady, he thinks. This time it's just cancer, and I can live with that. The idea surprises him into laughter. It hurts. From the other room comes the sound of three people applauding. Hodges is pretty sure he knows what it means, and he's not wrong. The message on Holly's computer reads, Z, the end, is experiencing technical difficulties. Below is this. Call 1-800-273-TALK.
It was that guy Jepson's idea,
Holly says, not looking up from what she's doing.
It's the National Suicide Prevention Hotline.
Good one, Hodges says. And those are good, too. You're a woman with hidden talents. In front of Holly is a line of joints. The one she adds makes an even dozen.
She's fast, Freddy says admiringly. And look how neat they are, like they came out of a machine.
Holly gives Hodges a defiant look.
My therapist says an occasional marijuana cigarette is perfectly okay. As long as I don't go overboard, that is, the way some people do.
Her eyes glide to Freddy, then back to Hodges.
Besides, these aren't for me. They're for you, Bill, if you need them.
Hodges thanks her and has a moment to reflect on how far the two of them have come and how pleasant, by and large, the trip has been. But too short. Far too short. Then his phone rings. It's Becky.
The name of the place is Heads and Skins. I told you it was cutesy horrible. Vi doesn't remember how to get there. I'm guessing she had more than a few shots on the ride just to get her motor running. But she does remember they went north on the turnpike for quite a ways and stopped for gas at a place called Thurston's Garage after they got off. Does that help?
Yeah, a ton. Thanks, Becky. He ends the call. Holly, I need you to find Thurston's Garage north of the city. Then I want you to call Hertz at the airport and rent the biggest four-wheel drive they've got left. We're going on a road trip. My Jeep, Jerome begins, is small, light, and old, Hodges says, although these are not the only reasons he wants a different vehicle built to go in the snow. It'll be fine to get us out to the airport, though.
What about me?
Freddy asks. Which sec, Hodges says, as promised. It'll be like a dream come true.
20. Jane Elsberry was a perfectly normal baby. At 6 pounds 9 ounces, a little underweight, in fact. But by the time she was 7, she weighed 90 pounds and was familiar with the chant that sometimes haunts her dreams to this day. Fatty, fatty, 2x4, can't get through the bathroom door, so she does it on the floor. In June of 2010, when her mother took her to the Round Here concert as a 15th birthday present, she weighed 210. She could still get through the bathroom door with no problem, but it had become difficult for her to tie her shoes. Now, she's 20. Her weight has risen to 320, and when the voice begins to speak to her, from the free Zappa she got in the mail, everything it says makes perfect sense to her. The voice is low, calm, and reasonable. It tells her that nobody likes her, and everybody laughs at her. It points out that she can't stop eating. Even now, with tears running down her face, she's snarfing her way through a bag of chocolate pinwheel cookies, the kind with lots of gooey marshmallow inside. Like a more kindly version of the ghost of Christmas yet to come, who pointed out certain home truths to Ebenezer Scrooge, it sketches in a future which boils down to fat, fatter, fattest. The laughter along Carbine Street in hillbilly heaven where she and her parents live in a walk-up apartment. The looks of disgust. The jibes like, here comes the Goodyear blimp, and look out, don't let her fall on you. The voice explains, logically and reasonably, that she will never have a date. Will never be hired for a good job now that political correctness has rendered the circus fat lady extinct. That by the age of 40, she will have to sleep sitting up, because her enormous breasts will make it impossible for her lungs to do their work. And before she dies of a heart attack at 50, she'll be using a dustbuster to get the crumbs out of the deepest creases in her rolls of fat. When she tries to suggest to the voice that she could lose some weight, go to one of those clinics, maybe, it doesn't laugh. It only asks her, softly and sympathetically, where the money will come from when the combined incomes of her mother and father are barely enough to satisfy an appetite that is basically insatiable. When the voice suggests they'd be better off without her, she can only agree. Jane,
known to the denizens of Carbine Street as Fat Jane, lumbers into the bathroom and takes the bottle of OxyContin pills her father has for his bad back. She counts them. There are 30, which should be more than enough. She takes them 5 at a time, with milk, eating a chocolate marshmallow cookie after each swallow. She begins to float away. I'm going on a diet, she thinks. I'm going on a long, long diet. That's right, the voice from the Zapit tells her. And you'll never cheat on this one, Jane, will you? She takes the last 5 oxys. She tries to pick up the Zapit, but her fingers will no longer close on the slim console. And what does it matter? She could never catch the speedy pink fish in this condition anyway. Better to look out the window where the snow is bearing the world in clean linen. No more fatty, fatty 2x4, she thinks, and when she slips into unconsciousness, she goes with relief. 21.
Before going to Hertz, Hodges swings Jerome's Jeep into the turnaround in front of the Airport Hilton.
This is supposed to be witness protection?
Freddy asks.
This?
Hodges says, since I don't happen to have a safe house at my disposal, it will have to do. I'll register you under my name. You go in, you lock the door, you watch TV, you wait until this thing is over.
And change the dressing on that wound,
Holly says. Freddy ignores her. She's focused on Hodges.
How much trouble am I going to be in when it's over?
I don't know, and I don't have time to discuss it with you now.
Can I at least order room service?
There's a faint gleam in Freddy's bloodshot eyes.
I'm not in so much pain now, and I've got a wicked case of the munchies.
Knock yourself out, Hodges says. Jerome adds,
only check the peephole before you let in the waiter. Make sure it isn't one of Brady Hartsfield's men in black.
You're kidding,
Freddy says.
Right?
The hotel lobby is dead empty on this snowy afternoon.
Hodges, who feels as if he woke up to Pete's telephone call approximately 3 years ago, walks to the desk, does his business there, and comes back to where the others are sitting. Holly is tapping away at something on her iPad and doesn't look up. Freddy holds out her hand for the key folder, but Hodges gives it to Jerome instead. Room 522. Take her up, will you? I want to talk to Holly. Jerome raises his eyebrows, and when Hodges doesn't elaborate, he shrugs and takes Freddy by the arm.
John Shaft will now escort you to your suite.
She pushes his hand away.
Be lucky if it even has a minibar.
But she gets up and walks with him toward the elevators.
I found Thurston's garage,
Holly says.
It's 56 miles north on I-47. The direction the storm's coming from, unfortunately. After that, it's State Road 79. The weather really doesn't look good.
We'll be okay, Hodges says. Hertz is holding a Ford Expedition for us. It's a nice heavy vehicle, and you can give me the turn-by-turn later. I want to talk to you about something else. Gently, he takes her iPad and turns it off. Holly looks at him with her hands clasped in her lap, waiting.
22. Brady comes back from Carbine Street in hillbilly heaven, refreshed and exhilarated. The Ellsbury fatso was both easy and fun. He wonders how many guys it will take to get her body down from that third-floor apartment. He's guessing at least 4. And think of the coffin! Jumbo size! When he checks the website and finds it offline, his good mood collapses again. Yes, he expected Hodges would find a way to kill it, but he didn't expect it to happen so fast. And the phone number on the screen is as infuriating as the fuck you messages Hodges left on Debbie's blue umbrella during their first go-round. It's a suicide prevention hotline. He doesn't even have to check. He knows. And yes, Hodges will come. Plenty of people at Kiner Memorial know about this place. It's sort of legendary. But will he come straight in? Brady doesn't believe that for a minute. For one thing, the Detrette will know that many hunters leave their firearms out at camp, although few are as fully stocked with them as heads and skins. For another, and this is more important, The Det Ret is one sly hyena. 6 years older than when Brady first encountered him, true, undoubtedly shorter of wind and shakier of limb, but sly. The sort of slinking animal that doesn't come at you directly but goes for the hamstrings while you're looking elsewhere. So, I'm Hodges. What do I do? After giving this due consideration, Brady goes to the closet, and a brief check of Babineau's memory, what's left of it, is all it takes for him to choose outerwear that belongs to the body he's inhabiting. Everything fits perfectly. He adds a pair of gloves to protect his arthritic fingers and goes outside. The snow is only a moderate fall and the branches of the trees are still. All that will change later, but for now, it's pleasant enough to go for a tramp around the property. He walks to a woodpile, whose surface is covered with an old canvas tarp and a few inches of fresh powder. Beyond it are 2 or 3 acres of old-growth pines and spruces separating heads and skins from Big Bob's bear camp. It's perfect. He needs to visit the gun closet. The scar is fine, but there are other things in there he can use. Oh, Detective Hodges, Brady thinks, hurrying back the way he came. I've got such a surprise. Such a surprise for you. 23. Jerome listens carefully to what Hodges tells him, then shakes his head. No way, Bill. I need to come.
What you need to do is go home and be with your family, Hodges says. You especially need to be with your sister. She had a close call yesterday.
They are sitting in a corner of the Hilton's reception area, speaking in low voices, although even the desk clerk has retired to the nether regions. Jerome is leaning forward, hands planted on his thighs, his face set in a stubborn frown. If Holly's going,
it's different for us, Holly says. You must see that, Jerome. I don't get along with my mother. Never have. I see her once or twice a year at most. I'm always glad to leave, and I'm sure she's glad to see me go. As for Bill, you know he'll fight what he's got, but both of us know what the chances are. Your case is not like ours.
He's dangerous, Hodges says, and we can't count on the element of surprise. If he doesn't know I'll come for him, he's stupid. That's one thing he never was.
It was the three of us at the Mingo, Jerome says, and after you went into vapor lock, it was just Holly and me. We did okay.
Last time was different, Holly says. Last time, he wasn't capable of mind control juju.
I still want to come.
Hodges nods. I understand. But I'm still the wheel dog, and the wheel dog says no.
But there's another reason, Holly says. A bigger reason. The repeater's offline, and the website's shut down. But that leaves almost 250 active Zebbets. There's been at least one suicide already, and we can't tell the police all of what's going on. Isabel James thinks Bill's a meddler, and anyone else would think we're crazy. If anything happens to us, there's only you. Don't you understand that?
What I understand is that you're cutting me out, Jerome says. All at once he sounds like the weedy young kid Hodges hired to mow his lawn all those years ago. There's more, Hodges says. I might have to kill him. In fact, I think that's the most likely outcome.
Jesus, Bill, I know that.
But to the cops and the world at large, the man I killed would be a respected neurosurgeon named Felix Babineau. I've wiggled out of some tight legal corners since opening Finders Keepers, but this one could be different. Do you want to risk being charged as an accessory to aggravated manslaughter, defined in this state as the reckless killing of a human being through culpable negligence? Maybe even murder one?
Jerome squirms.
You're willing to let Holly risk that? Holly says, you're the one with most of your life still ahead of you.
Hodges leans forward, even though it hurts to do so, and cups the broad nape of Jerome's neck. I know you don't like it. I didn't expect you would, but it's the right thing for all the right reasons.
Jerome thinks it over and sighs. I see your point.
Hodges and Holly wait, both of them knowing this is not quite good enough.
Okay, Jerome says at last. I hate it, but okay.
Hodges gets up,
hand to his side to hold in the pain. Then let's snag that SUV. The storm's coming, and I'd like to get as far up I-47 as possible before we meet it.
24. Jerome is leaning against the hood of his Wrangler when they come out of the rental office with the keys to an all-wheel drive Expedition. He hugs Holly and whispers in her ear,
"Last chance. Take me along."
She shakes her head against his chest. He lets her go and turns to Hodges, who's wearing an old fedora, the brim already white with snow. Hodges puts out a hand.
"Under other circumstances, I'd go with the hug, but right now hugs hurt."
Jerome settles for a strong grip. There are tears in his eyes.
"Be careful, man. Stay in touch. And bring back the hollyberry."
"I intend to do that," Hodges says.
Jerome watches them get into the Expedition, Bill climbing behind the wheel with obvious discomfort. Jerome knows they're right. Of the three of them, he's the least expendable. That doesn't mean he likes it, or feels less like a little kid being sent home to mommy. He would go after them, he thinks, except for the thing Holly said in that deserted hotel lobby.
"If anything happens to us, there's only you."
Jerome gets into his Jeep and heads home. As he merges onto the crosstown, a strong premonition comes to him. He's never going to see either one of his friends again. He tries to tell himself that superstitious bullshit, but he can't quite make it work. 25.
By the time Hodges and Holly leave the crosstown for I-47 North, the snow is no longer just kidding around. Driving into it reminds Hodges of a science fiction movie he saw with Holly, the moment when the starship Enterprise goes into hyperdrive, or whatever they call it. The speed limit signs are flashing snow alert and 40 miles per hour, but he pegs the speedometer at 60 and will hold it there as long as he can, which might be for 30 miles. Perhaps only 20. A few cars in the travel lane honk at him to slow down, and passing the lumbering 18-wheelers, each one dragging a rooster-tail fog of snow behind it, is an exercise in controlled fear. It's almost half an hour before Holly breaks the silence.
"You brought the guns, didn't you? That's what's in the drawstring bag?"
"Yeah."
She unbuckles her seatbelt, which makes him nervous, and fishes the bag out of the back seat.
"Are they loaded?"
"The Glock is. The .38 you'll have to load it yourself. That one's yours."
"I don't know how."
Hodges offered to take her to the shooting range with him once, start the process of getting her qualified to carry concealed, but she refused vehemently. He never offered again, believing she would never need to carry a gun, believing he would never put her in that position. "You'll figure it out. It's not hard." She examines the Victory, keeping her hands well away from the trigger and the muzzle well away from her face. After a few seconds, she succeeds in rolling the barrel. "Okay, now the bullets. There are two boxes of Winchester 38s, 130 grain, full metal jacket."
She opens one, looks at the shells sticking up like mini warheads, and grimaces.
"Oof."
"Can you do it?" He's passing another truck, the Expedition enveloped in snow fog. There are still strips of bare pavement in the travel lane, but this passing lane is now snow-covered, and the truck on their right seems to go on forever. "If you can't, that's okay."
"You don't mean can I load it?" she says, sounding angry. "I see how to do that. A kid could do it."
"Sometimes they do," Hodges thinks.
"What you mean is can I shoot him?"
"It probably won't come to that, but if it did, could you?"
"Yes,"
Holly says, and loads the Victory's 6 chambers. She pushes the cylinder back into place gingerly, lips turned down and eyes squinted into slits, as if afraid the gun will explode in her hand.
"Now, where's the safety switch?"
"There isn't any. Not on revolvers. The hammer's down, and that's all the safety that you need. Put it in your purse, the ammo too."
She does as he says, then places the bag between her feet.
"And stop biting your lips. You're going to make them bleed."
"I'll try. But this is a very stressful situation, Bill."
"I know."
They're back in the travel lane again. The mile markers seem to float past with excruciating slowness,
and the pain in his side is a hot jellyfish with long tentacles that now seem to reach everywhere, even up into his throat. Once, 20 years ago, he was shot in the leg by a thief cornered in a vacant lot. That pain had been like this, but eventually it had gone away. He doesn't think this one ever will. The drugs may mute it for a while, but probably not for long.
What if we find this place and he's not there, Bill? Have you thought about that? Have you?
He has, and has no idea what the next step would be in that case. Let's not worry about it unless we have to. His phone rings. It's in his coat pocket, and he hands it to Holly without looking away from the road ahead.
Hello. This is Holly.
She listens, then mouths, "Miss Pretty Gray Eyes," to Hodges.
Uh-huh. Yes. Okay, I understand. No, he can't. His hands are full right now. But I'll tell him.
She listens some more, then says,
"I could tell you, Izzy, but you wouldn't believe me."
She closes his phone with a snap and slips it back into his pocket. "Suicides?" Hodges asks.
3 so far, counting the boy who shot himself in front of his father.
Zappets?
At 2 of the 3 locations. Responders at the 3rd one haven't had a chance to look. They were trying to save the kid, but it was too late. He hung himself. Izzy sounds half out of her mind. She wanted to know everything.
If anything happens to us, Jerome will tell Pete, and Pete will tell her. I think she's almost ready to listen.
We have to stop him before he kills more.
He's probably killing more right now, Hodges thinks. We will. The miles roll by. Hodges is forced to reduce his speed to 50, and when he feels the expedition do a loose little shimmy in the slipstream of a Walmart double box, he drops to 45. It's past 3 o'clock, and the light is starting to drain from this snowy day when Holly speaks again.
Thank you.
He turns his head briefly, looking a question at her.
For not making me beg to come along.
I'm only doing what your therapist would want, Hodges says, getting you a bunch of closure.
Is that a joke? I can never tell when you're joking. You have an extremely dry sense of humor, Bill.
No joke. This is our business, Holly, nobody else's.
A green sign looms out of the white murk.
SR-79, Holly says. That's our exit.
Thank God, Hodges says. I hate turnpike driving even when the sun's out.
26. Thurston's garage is 15 miles east along the state highway, according to Holly's iPad, but it takes them half an hour to get there. The expedition handles the snow-covered road easily, but now the wind is picking up. It will be blowing at gale force by 8 o'clock, according to the radio, and when it gusts, throwing sheets of snow across the road, Hodges eases down to 15 miles an hour until he can see again. As he turns in at the big yellow Shell sign, Holly's phone rings. "Handle that," he says. "I'll be as quick as I can." He gets out, yanking his fedora down hard to keep it from blowing away. The wind machine guns his coat collar against his neck as he tramps through the snow to the garage office. His entire midsection is throbbing. It feels as if he's swallowed live coals. The gas pumps in the adjacent parking area are empty except for the idling expedition. The plowboys have departed to spend a long night earning their money as the first big storm of the year rants and raves. For one eerie moment, Hodges thinks it's Library Al behind the counter. Same green dickies, same popcorn white hair exploding around the edges of his John Deere cap.
"What brings you out on a wild afternoon like this?" the old guy asks, then peers past Hodges. "Or is it night already?"
"A little of both," Hodges says. He has no time for conversation. Back in the city, kids may be jumping out of apartment building windows and swallowing pills, but it's how the job is done. "Would you be Mr. Thurston?"
"In the flesh. Since you didn't pull up at the pumps, I'd almost wonder if you came to rob me. But you look a little too prosperous for that. City fella?"
"I am," Hodges says, "and in kind of a hurry."
"City fellows usually are."
Thurston puts down the Field and Stream he's been reading.
"What is it, then? Directions? Man, I hope it's somewhere close, the way this one's shaping up."
"I think it is. hunting camp called Heads and Skins. Ring a bell?
Oh, sure, Thurston says. The doctor's place, right near Big Bob's bear camp. Those fellas usually gas up their jags and porches here, either on their way out or their way back.
He pronounces Porsches as if he's talking about the things old folks sit on in the evening to watch the sun go down.
Wouldn't be nobody out there now, though. Hunting season ends December 9th, and I'm talking bow hunting. Gun hunting ends the last day of November, and all those docs use rifles, big ones. I think they like to pretend they're in Africa.
Nobody stopped earlier today? Would have been driving an old car with a lot of primer on it?
Nope.
A young man comes out of the garage bay, wiping his hands on a rag.
I saw that car, Granddad. A Chevrolet. I was out front talking with Spider Willis when it went by.
He turns his attention to Hodges.
I only noticed because there's not much the way he was headed, and that car was no snow dog like the one you've got out there.
Can you give me directions to the camp?
The easiest thing in the world,
Thurston says.
Or would be on a fair day. You keep on going the way you were heading about...
He turns his attention to the younger man.
What would you say, Duane? 3 miles?
More like 4,
Duane says.
Well, split the difference and call it 3.5, Thurston says. You'll be looking for 2 red posts on your left. They're tall, 6 feet or so, but the state plow's been by twice already, so you want to keep a sharp eye because there won't be much of them to see. You'll have to bull your way through the snowbank, you know, unless you brought a shovel.
I think what I'm driving will do it, Hodges says.
Yeah, most likely, and no harm to your SUV since the snow hasn't had a chance to pack down. Anyway, you go in 1 mile or maybe 2 and the road splits. One fork goes to Big Bob's, the other to Heads and Skins. Now, I can't remember which one is which, but there used to be arrow signs.
Still are, Duane says. Big Bob's is on the right, Heads and Skins on the left. I ought to know. I reshingled Big Bob Rowan's roof last October. This must be pretty important, mister, to get you out on a day like this.
Will my SUV make it on that road, do you think?
Sure, Duane says. Trees will still be holding up most of the snow, and the road runs downhill to the lake. Making it out might be a little trickier.
Hodges takes his wallet from his back pocket. Christ, even that hurts, and fishes out his police ID with retired stamped on it. To it he adds one of his finder's keeper's business cards and lays them both on the counter. Can you gentlemen keep a secret? They nod, faces bright with curiosity. I've got a subpoena to serve, right? It's a civil case, and the money at stake runs to 7 figures. The man you saw go by, the one in the primered-up Chevy, is a doctor named Babineau.
See him every November,
the elder Thurston says.
Got an attitude about him, you know? Like he's always seeing you from under the end of his nose. But he drives a Beamer.
Today he's driving whatever he could get his hands on, Hodges says. And if I don't serve these papers by midnight, the case goes bye-bye, and an old lady who doesn't have much won't get her payday.
Malpractice?
Duane asks. Don't like to say, but I'm going in. Which you will remember, Hodges thinks. That and Babineau's name. The old man says,
There are a couple of snowmobiles out back. I could let you have one if you want, and the Arctic Cat has a high windshield. It'd still be a chilly ride, but you'd be guaranteed getting back.
Hodges is touched by the offer, coming as it does to a complete stranger, but shakes his head. Snowmobiles are noisy beasts. He has an idea that the man now in residence at Heads and Skins, be he Brady or Babineau or a weird mixture of the two, knows he's coming. What Hodges has on his side is that his quarry doesn't know when. My partner and I will get in, he says, and worry about getting out later.
Nice and quiet, huh?
Duane says, and puts a finger to his lips, which are curved in a smile. That's the ticket. Is there someone I could call for a ride if I do get stuck?
Call right here.
Thurston hands him a card from the plastic tray by the cash register.
I'll send either Duane or Spider Willis. It might not be until late tonight, and it'll cost you $40, but with a case worth millions, I guess you can afford that.
Do cell phones work out here?
5 bars even in dirty weather, Duane says. There's a tower on the south side of the lake.
Good to know. Thank you. Thank you both. He turns to go, and the old man says,
That hat you're wearing is no good in this weather. Take this.
He holds out a knit hat with a big orange pom-pom on top.
Can't do nothing about those shoes, though.
Hodges thanks him, takes the hat, then removes his fedora and puts it on the counter. It feels like bad luck. It feels like exactly the right thing to do. Collateral, he says. Both of them grin, the younger one with quite a few more teeth.
Good enough, the old man says. But are you 100% sure you want to be driving out to the lake, mister?
He glances down at the finder's keeper's business card.
Mr. Hodges, because you look a trifle peaky.
It's a chest cold, Hodges says. I get one every damn winter. Thank you, both of you. And if Dr. Babineau should by any chance call here?
Wouldn't give him the time of day, Thurston says. He's a snooty one.
Hodges starts for the door, and a pain like none he's ever felt before comes out of nowhere, lancing up from his belly all the way to his jawline. It's like being shot by a burning arrow, and he staggers.
Are you sure you're okay?
The old man asks, starting around the counter.
Yeah, I'm fine.
He's far from that.
Leg cramp from driving. I'll be back for my hat.
With luck, he thinks.
27. You were in there a long time, Holly says. I hope you gave them a very good story.
Subpoena. Hodges doesn't need to say more. They've used the subpoena story more than once. Everyone likes to help as long as they're not the ones being served. Who called? Thinking it must have been Jerome to see how they're doing.
Izzy James. They've had two more suicide calls. One attempted and one successful. The attempted was a girl who jumped out of a second-story window. She landed on a snowbank and just broke some bones. The other was a boy who hung himself in his closet. Left a note on his pillow. Just one word, Beth, and a broken heart.
The expedition's wheels spin a little when Hodges drops it into gear and rolls back onto the state road. He has to drive with his low beams on. The brights turn the falling snow into a sparkling white wall.
We have to do this ourselves, she says. If it's Brady, no one will ever believe it. He'll pretend to be Babineau and spin some story about how he was scared and ran away.
And never called the police himself after Library Al shot his wife? Hodges says. I'm not sure that would hold.
Maybe not. But what if he can jump to someone else? If he could jump to Babineau, who else could he jump to? We have to do this ourselves, even if it means we end up getting arrested for murder. Do you think that could happen, Bill? Do you?
We'll worry about it later.
I'm not sure I could shoot a person. Not even Brady Hartsfield, if he looks like someone else.
He repeats. We'll worry about it later.
Fine. Where did you get that hat?
Swapped it for my fedora.
The puffball on top is silly, but it looks warm.
Do you want it?
No. But, Bill...
Jesus, Holly, what?
You look awful.
Flattery will get you nowhere.
Be sarcastic. Fine. How far is it to where we're going?
The general consensus back there was 3.5 miles on this road. Then a camp road. Silence for 5 minutes as they creep through the blowing snow. And the main body of the storm is still coming, Hodges reminds himself.
Bill.
What now?
You have no boots. And I'm all out of Nicorette.
Spark up one of those joints, why don't you? But keep an eye out for a couple of red posts on the left while you do it. They should be coming up soon. Holly doesn't light a joint. Just sits forward, looking to the left. When the expedition skids again, the rear end flirting first left and then right, she doesn't appear to notice. A minute later, she points.
Is that them?
It is. The passing plows have buried all but the last 18 inches or so, but that bright red is impossible to miss or mistake. Hodges feathers the brakes, brings the expedition to a stop, then turns it so it's facing the snowbank. He tells Holly what he sometimes used to tell his daughter when he took her on the wild cups at Lakewood Amusement Park. Hold on to your false teeth. Holly, always the literalist, says,
I don't have any.
But she does put a bracing hand on the dashboard. Hodges steps down gently on the gas and rolls at the snowbank. The thud he expected doesn't come. Thurston was right about the snow not yet having a chance to pack and harden. It explodes away to either side and up onto the windshield, momentarily blinding him. He shoves the wipers into overdrive, and when the glass clears, the expedition is pointing down a one-lane camp road rapidly filling with snow. Every now and then, more flumps down from the overhanging branches. He sees no tracks from a previous car, but that means nothing. By now, they'd be gone. He kills the headlights and advances at a creep. The band of white between the trees is just visible enough to serve as a guide track. The road seems endless, sloping, switching back, then sloping again. But eventually, they come to the place where it splits left and right. Hodges doesn't have to get out and check the arrows. Ahead on the left, through the snow and the trees, he can see a faint glimmer of light. That's heads and skins, and someone is home. He crimps the wheel and begins rolling slowly down the right-hand fork. Neither of them looks up and sees the video camera, but it sees them.
28. By the time Hodges and Holly burst through the snowbank left by the plow, Brady is sitting in front of the TV, fully dressed in Babineau's winter coat and boots. He's left off the gloves. He wants his hands bare in case he has to use the scar. But there's a black balaclava lying across one thigh. When the time comes, he'll don it to cover Babineau's face and silver hair. His eyes never leave the television as he nervously stirs the pens and pencils sticking out of the ceramic skull. A sharp lookout is absolutely necessary. When Hodges comes, he'll kill his headlights. Will he have the nigger lawn boy with him? Brady wonders. Wouldn't that be sweet? Two for the price of... And there he is. He was afraid the debt wretch's vehicle might get by him in the thickening snow, but that was a needless worry. The snow is white, and the SUV is a solid black rectangle sliding through it. Brady leans forward, squinting, but can't tell if there's only one person in the cabin, or two, or half a fucking dozen. He's got the scar, and with it he could wipe out an entire squad if he had to, but that would spoil the fun. He'd like Hodges alive. To start with, at least. Only one more question needs to be answered. Will he turn left and bore straight in, or right? Brady is betting K. William Hodges will choose the fork that leads to Big Bob's, and he's right. As the SUV disappears into the snow, with a brief flash of the taillights as Hodges negotiates the first turn, Brady puts the skull pin holder down next to the TV remote and picks up an item that has been waiting on the end table. A perfectly legal item when used the right way, which it never was by Babineau and his cohorts. They may have been good doctors, but out here in the woods they were often bad boys. He pulls this valuable piece of equipment over his head and lets it hang against the front of his coat by the elastic strap. Then he pulls on the balaclava, grabs the scar, and heads out. His heart is beating fast and hard, and for the time being, at least, the arthritis in Babineau's fingers seems to be completely gone. Payback is a bitch, and the bitch is back. 29. Holly doesn't ask Hodges why he took the right-hand fork. She's neurotic, but not stupid. He drives at a walking pace, looking to his left, measuring the lights to his left. When he's even with them, he stops the SUV and switches off the engine. It's full dark now, and when he turns to look at Holly, she has the fleeting impression that his head has been replaced by a skull. "Stay here," he says in a low voice. "Text Jerome. Tell him we're okay. I'm going to cut through those woods and take him." "You don't mean alive, do you?"
"Not if I see him with one of those zappets. And probably even if I don't," he thinks. "We can't take the risk."
"Then you believe it's him, Brady?"
"Even if it's Babineau, he's part of this, neck deep in it. But yes, at some point he has become convinced that Brady Hartsfield's mind is now running Babineau's body. The intuition is too strong to deny and has gained the weight of fact. God help me if I kill him and I'm wrong, he thinks. Only how would I know? How could I ever be sure? He expects Holly to protest, to tell him she has to come along, but all she says is,
I don't think I can drive this thing out of here if something happens to you, Bill.
He hands her Thurston's card. If I'm not back in 10 minutes, no, make it 15, call this guy.
What if I hear shots?
If it's me and I'm okay, I'll honk the horn of Library Al's car. 2 quick beeps. If you don't hear that, drive the rest of the way to the other camp, Big Bob's What's It. Break in, find somewhere to hide, call Thurston. Hodges leans across the center console, and for the first time since he's known her, kisses her lips. She's too startled to kiss him back, but she doesn't pull away. When he does, she looks down in confusion and says the first thing that comes into her mind.
Bill, you're in shoes. You'll freeze.
There's not so much snow in the trees, only a couple of inches, and really cold feet are the least of his worries at this point. He finds the toggle switch that kills the interior lights. As he leaves the expedition, grunting with suppressed pain, she can hear the rising whisper of the wind in the fir trees. If it were a voice, it would be mourning. Then the door shuts. Holly sits where she is, watching his dark shape merge with the dark shapes of the trees. And when she can no longer tell which is which, she gets out and follows his tracks. The Victory 38 that Hodges' father once carried as a beat cop back in the 50s when Sugar Heights was still woodland is in her coat pocket. 30.
Hodges makes his way toward the lights of Heads and Skins, one plodding step at a time. Snow flicks his face and coats his eyelids. That burning arrow is back, lighting him up inside, frying him. His face is running with sweat. At least my feet aren't hot, he thinks, and that's when he stumbles over a snow-covered log and goes sprawling. He lands squarely on his left side and buries his face in the arm of his coat to keep from screaming. Hot liquid spills into his crotch. Wet my pants, he thinks. Wet my pants just like a baby. When the pain recedes a little, he gathers his legs under him and tries to stand. He can't do it. The wetness is turning cold. He can actually feel his dick shriveling to get away from it. He grabs a low-hanging branch and tries again to get up. It snaps off. He looks at it stupidly, feeling like a cartoon character. Wile E. Coyote, maybe, and tosses it aside. As he does, a hand hooks into his armpit. His surprise is so great he almost screams. Then Holly is whispering in his ear,
Upsa-daisy, Bill. Come on.
With her help, he's finally able to make it to his feet. The lights are close now, no more than 40 yards through the screening trees. He can see the snow frosting her hair and lighting on her cheeks. All at once he finds himself remembering the office of an antique book dealer named Andrew Halliday, and how he, Holly, and Jerome had discovered Halliday lying dead on the floor. He told them to stay back, but...
Holly, if I told you to go back, would you do it?
No,
she's whispering. They both are.
You'll probably have to shoot him, and you can't get there without help.
You're supposed to be my backup, Holly. My insurance policy. The sweat is pouring off him like oil. Thank God his coat is a long one. He doesn't want Holly to know he pissed himself.
Jerome is your insurance policy, she says. I'm your partner. That's why you brought me, whether you know it or not. And it's what I want. It's all I ever wanted. Now come on. Lean on me. Let's finish this.
They move slowly through the remaining trees. Hodges can't believe how much of his weight she's taking. They pause at the edge of the clearing that surrounds the house. There are 2 lighted rooms. Judging by the subdued glow coming from the one closest to them, Hodges thinks it must be the kitchen. A single light on in there. Maybe the one over the stove. Coming from the other window, he can make out an unsteady flicker that probably means a fireplace. "That's where we're going," he says, pointing. "And from here on, we're soldiers on night patrol, which means we crawl."
"Can you?"
"Yeah."
"It might actually be easier than walking."
"See the chandelier?"
"Yes. It looks all bony. Oof."
"That's the living room, and that's where he'll probably be. If he's not, we'll wait until he shows. If he's got one of those zappets, I intend to shoot him. No hands up, no lie down, and put your hands behind your back. Do you have a problem with that?"
"Absolutely not."
They drop to their hands and knees. Hodges leaves the Glock in his coat pocket, not wanting to dunk it in the snow.
"Bill," her whisper so low, he can barely hear it over the rising wind. He turns to look at her. She's holding out one of her gloves. "Too small," he says, and thinks of Johnny Cochran saying, "If the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit." Crazy what goes through a person's mind at times like this. Only, has there ever in his life been a time like this?
"Force it," she whispers. "You need to keep your gun hand warm."
She's right, and he manages to get it most of the way on. It's too short to get over all of his hand, but his fingers are covered, and that's all that matters. They crawl, Hodges slightly in the lead. The pain is still bad, but now that he's off his feet, the arrow in his guts is smoldering rather than burning.
Got to save some energy, though, he thinks. Just enough.
It's 40 or 50 feet from the edge of the woods to the window with the chandelier hanging in it, and his uncovered hand has lost all feeling by the time they're halfway there. He can't believe he's brought his best friend to this place in this moment, crawling through the snow like children playing a war game miles from any help. He had his reasons, and they made sense back in that airport Hilton. Now, not so much. He looks left, at the silent hulk of Library Al's Malibu. He looks right, and sees a snow-covered woodpile. He starts to look ahead again, at the living room window, then snaps his head back to the woodpile. Alarm bells ringing just a little too late. There are tracks in the snow. The angle was wrong to see them from the edge of the woods, but he can see them clearly now. They lead from the back of the house to that stack of fireplace fuel. He came outside through the kitchen door, Hodges thinks. That's why the light was on in there. I should have guessed. I would have, if I hadn't been so sick. He scrabbles for the Glock, but the too small glove slows his grip, and when he finally gets hold of it and tries to pull it out, the gun snags in the pocket. Meanwhile, a dark shape has risen from behind the woodpile. The shape covers the 15 feet between it and them in 4 great looping strides. The face is that of an alien in a horror movie, featureless except for the round, projecting eyes.
"Holly, look out!"
She lifts her head just as the butt of the scar comes down to meet it. There's a sickening crack, and she drops face first into the snow with her arms thrown out to either side, a puppet with its strings cut. Hodges frees the Glock from his coat pocket just as the butt comes down again. Hodges both feels and hears his wrist break. He sees the Glock land in the snow and almost disappear. Still on his knees, Hodges looks up and sees a tall man, much taller than Brady Hartsfield, standing in front of Holly's motionless form. He's wearing a balaclava and night vision goggles. "He saw us as soon as we came out of the trees," Hodges thinks dully. "For all I know, he saw us in the trees while I was pulling on Holly's glove."
"Hello, Detective Hodges."
Hodges doesn't reply. He wonders if Holly is still alive, and if she'll ever recover from the blow she's just been dealt, if she is. But of course, that's stupid. Brady isn't going to give her any chance to recover.
"You're coming inside with me," Brady says. "The question is whether or not we bring her, or leave her out here to turn into a popsicle."
And, as if he's read Hodges' mind, for all Hodges knows, he can do that.
"Oh, she's still alive. At least for now. I can see her back going up and down. Although, after a hit that hard, and with her face in the snow, who knows for how long?"
"I'll carry her," Hodges says, and he will, no matter how much it hurts.
"Okay,"
No pause to think it over, and Hodges knows it's what Brady expected and what Brady wanted. He's one step ahead, has been all along. And whose fault is that? Mine. Entirely mine. It's what I get for playing the Lone Ranger yet again. But what else could I do? Who would ever have believed it?
Pick her up, Brady says. Let's see if you really can. Because, tell you what, you look mighty shaky to me.
Hodges gets his arms under Holly. In the woods, he couldn't make it to his feet after he fell, but now he gathers everything he has left and does a clean and jerk with her limp body. He staggers, almost goes down, and finds his balance again. The burning arrow is gone, incinerated in the forest fire it has touched off inside him, but he hugs her to his chest.
That's good. Brady sounds genuinely admiring. Now let's see if you can make it to the house.
Somehow, Hodges does.
31. The wood in the fireplace is burning well and throwing a stuporous heat. Gasping for breath, the snow on his borrowed hat melting and running down his face in slushy streams, Hodges gets to the middle of the room and then goes to his knees, having to cradle Holly's neck in the crook of his elbow because of his broken wrist, which is swelling up like a sausage. He manages to keep her head from banging on the hardwood floor, and that's good. Her head has taken enough abuse tonight. Brady has removed his coat, the night vision goggles, and the balaclava. It's Babineau's face and Babineau's silvery hair, now in unaccustomed disarray. But it's Brady Hartsfield, all right. Hodges' last doubts have departed.
Has she got a gun?
No. The man who looks like Felix Babineau smiles.
Well, here's what I'm going to do, Bill. I'll search your pockets, and if I do find a gun, I'll blow her narrow ass into the next state. How's that for a deal?
It's a .38, Hodges says. She's right-handed, so if she brought it, it's probably in the right front pocket of her coat. Brady bends, keeping the scar trained on Hodges as he does so, finger on the trigger and the butt plate braced against the right side of his chest. He finds the revolver, examines it briefly, then tucks it into his belt at the small of his back. In spite of his pain and despair, Hodges feels a certain sour amusement. Brady's probably seen badass dudes do that in 100 TV shows and action movies, but it really only works with automatics, which are flat. On the hooked rug, Holly makes a snoring sound deep in her throat. One foot gives a spastic jerk, then goes still.
What about you? Brady asks. Any other weapons? The ever-popular throwdown gun strapped to your ankle, perhaps?
Hodges shakes his head.
Just to be on the safe side, why don't you hoist up your pants legs for me?
Hodges does it, revealing soaked shoes, wet socks, and nothing else.
Excellent. Now take off your coat and throw it on the couch.
Hodges unzips it and manages to keep quiet while he shrugs out of it, but when he tosses it, a bull's horn gores him from crotch to heart, and he groans. Babineau's eyes widen.
Real pain or fake? Live or Memorex? Judging from a quite striking weight loss, I'm going to say it's real. What's up, Detective Hodges? What's going on with you?
Cancer. Pancreatic.
Oh, goodness, that's bad. Not even Superman can beat that one. But cheer up. I may be able to shorten your suffering.
Do what you want with me, Hodges says. Just let her alone.
Brady looks at the woman on the floor with great interest. This would not, by any chance, be the woman who smashed in what used to be my head, is it?
The locution strikes him funny and he laughs. No. The world has become a camera lens, zooming in and out with every beat of his laboring pacemaker-assisted heart. Holly Gibney was the one who thumped you. She's gone back to live with her parents in Ohio. That's Kara Winston, my assistant. The name comes to him from nowhere, and there's no hesitation as he speaks it.
An assistant who just decided to come with you on a do-or-die mission. I find that a little hard to believe.
I promised her a bonus. She needs the money.
And where, pray tell, is your nigger lawn boy?
Hodges briefly considers telling Brady the truth, that Jerome is back in the city.